A little less than 10 years ago, Islamic State captured Mosul, Iraq's second city, home to perhaps 2 million people. At around this point, Islamic State controlled nearly half of Iraq and perhaps a third of Syria. Over the next few years, Islamic State as a geographic entity was more or less dismantled by a US-led military campaign. But as the world was reminded in characteristically brutal fashion by last week's massacre in a Moscow theater, Islamic State never entirely went away. The branch of Islamic State which claimed the attack upon Crocus City Hall was Islamic State Khorasan Province, or ISIS-K. Based largely in Afghanistan, ISIS-K were also assumed responsible for January's bombing of a commemoration for the late Iranian general Qasem Soleimani in Iran. Though ISIS-K clearly possesses a long reach, even that is not the limit of the sweep of Islamic State. A variation of the group is also active across Africa, flourishing especially in those countries where the rule of law is either non-existent or in the gift of indifferent and/or incompetent military juntas. It is depressingly likely that the current war between Israel and Hamas will energize Islamic State further wherever it is. Why did Islamic State strike Moscow? What does Islamic State want now? And are they poised for an unwelcome resurgence? This is the Foreign Desk.
Back in the day, Putin had two sources of legitimacy. He was either the great provider and he was the fearsome defender. Now, for most Russians, actually, life is not getting better anymore. He is no longer the great provider. So he's had to double down on his role as the protector of the motherland. Generally speaking, that this attack could happen absolutely undermines his standing as this great provider, the granddad who can keep everyone safe.
The war in Gaza is certainly going to radicalize large portion of disenfranchised communities across the Middle East and Central Asia. We're already seeing it through propaganda, through posts and videos on social media. And I think Middle Eastern states are acutely aware of these threats. And that's been part of their deep concern about the prolongation of the war as well.
Some leaders in the West, military leaders, have thought about the interventions in Africa as a kind of management. The main priority is to stop attacks from these outfits to take place in Europe. And that, I think, is kind of the same thing that Russia is thinking. The problem with that is that you don't have a long-term strategy and you will encounter large-scale problems when you continue. So I don't think the Russians would do any better than France in the long term.
Welcome to the Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. I'm joined first of all by Mark Galeotti, a political scientist, Russia expert, and author of several books on Russia, including Putin's Wars, From Chechnya to Ukraine. Mark, let's start with last Friday's attack in Moscow. Is it possible to sum up what Islamic State's grievance with Russia would be at this point?
Well, generally, from the point of view of Islamic State, Russia is one more of the so-called crusader states. In other words, it is opposed to Islamic State, and that's quite enough. But particularly for Islamic State Khorasan, which is the regional affiliate, shall we say, that was responsible. I mean, it's based in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Central Asia. And it has long seen Russia as the closest real enemy. America is a long way away once it's fled Afghanistan. But Russia is immediately there on its borders and from its point of view is the nearest, shall we say, serious target of interest.
Well, that does bring us, your mention of the United States, to the extraordinary subplot of this bombing, which was that a few weeks before it occurred, the US had warned publicly, and one assumes very much privately, that something like this was likely, an attack by Islamic State on large gatherings in Russia. They even mentioned the possibility of a concert being targeted. Why did President Vladimir Putin ignore that warning?
I mean, it's a tricky one to answer because, first of all, we don't really know just how specific the actual warning that was given to the Russian government was. The Americans say it really was pretty specific. The Russians say it was quite general. The only thing we have is a public announcement that was made by the embassy in Moscow to US citizens there on the 7th of the month, saying that for the next 48 hours, you should be aware of a potential risk to any large gatherings, including concerts. The thing was, in terms of why Putin responded the way he did, I think, first of all, it's simply because, from his point of view, his paranoid mindset is such that instead of actually seeing this as a genuine act of, frankly, altruism, instead he saw it in the context of his forthcoming presidential election. And his view was that any kind of warning which might deter some voters from turning up to crowded polling stations is actually an attempt to undermine his election, largely because he, I don't think, would be above issuing a fake warning as an information operation. He assumed that was being done to him. And then particularly once the actual window of that particular warning passed without any kind of such attack, he thought that proved that the Americans were actually up to no good. So I think from that point of view, it's really a case that Putin just could not recognize that there could possibly be, in this time of particular crisis, still room for some kind of altruistic gesture by Washington.
Would it be widely understood among Russian people that this warning had been issued by the United States? Would it have been much reported by Russian media?
Well, absolutely, for the simple reason that only a few days before the attack, Putin chose to go public, poo-pooing the whole notion and basically exactly accusing the Americans of having launched an attempt to undermine the elections. So ironically, in that context, it's Putin who ensured that Russian people who are interested knew that there was such a warning.
Will Putin be tagged with any responsibility for this by any amount of the Russian public?
I think this is actually something that is going to be quite subversive in the sense that, look, back in the day, Putin had two sources of legitimacy. He was either the great provider, in whose reign Russians were living better lives than ever before, and he was the fearsome defender who was keeping the motherland safe. Now, for most Russians, actually, life is not getting better anymore. He is no longer the great provider. So he's had to double down on his role as the protector of the motherland. And, you know, regardless of specifics about whether he listened to a warning from the Americans or not, generally speaking, that this attack could happen absolutely undermines his standing as this great provider, the granddad who can keep everyone safe. And in that context, his attempts to blame Ukraine don't seem to be doing very much to help that.
On to the subject of those attempts, some of them exceedingly imaginative, to weave Ukraine into the narrative. Again, among Russian people, will they actually buy the Ukraine angle? It's always a tough thing to discern in any country where most of the news is propaganda of one sort or another, the extent to which anybody does actually believe it.
Yes, I think there's two ways one can actually look at this. I mean, obviously, as you say, the actual narrative itself is, well, call it imaginative, I think you're being excessively generous. But this idea that a collection of Tajiks have been mobilized under the wing of the Ukrainians in order to carry out a terrorist attack in Moscow and then flee directly to Ukraine is fairly hard to swallow. And frankly, most Russians do. And I think one can look at, for example, Russian social media, where already we're getting some memes emerging about ways of blaming the Ukrainians for things that are absolutely patently nothing to do with the Ukrainians. And even a sort of silly thing of, well, you know, why didn't you come to work on time? It was the Ukrainians. Why did you burn the toast? It was the Ukrainians. And this is the way actually humor is this incredibly subversive force today, just as it was in Soviet times. But the other thing is actually even looking at the state-controlled media, you can see on the one hand the usual toxic propagandists on television spouting whatever the Kremlin line of the moment is. But on the other hand, when one looks at reports and analyses carried out by people who are more, shall I say, professionally engaged or who often act as mouthpieces for the security community, there it's much, much more cautious. And I'm almost getting the sense, and this is obviously my overlaying it, but that they're actually almost embarrassed by the official line.
How does Putin, I guess, fight back against that narrative that this is somehow his failing? How does he fight back against the idea that people are disbelieving or indeed mocking the official narrative, trying to tie it to Ukraine? Because there is, of course, nothing the tyrant fears quite like the sound of laughter. You referred earlier to Putin's image as the great protector, and we have seen him over his years in power react to threats many of them more imaginary than real, but nevertheless reacting to those threats with extraordinary violence, whether in Chechnya, in Syria or Ukraine. Is he likely to feel obliged to make some sort of obvious demonstration against something which is very much an Islamic State target?
Under normal circumstances, one would have thought yes. But here's the interesting thing. He's actually trapped by his own rhetorical musings, in that having decided to say this is not about Islamic State, the actual trigger pullers may well have been jihadist militants, but essentially they were engaged and grandfathered by the Ukrainians. It then becomes very difficult for him to pick some nice cathartic target to launch a bunch of cruise missiles at and to tell the Russian people, there you go, you are avenged, we have hit the ringleaders. In terms of Ukraine, after all, there's really not much more he can do. Ironically enough, Russia was already in the middle of a multi-day campaign of missile and drone attacks on Ukraine. So he can't really deliver some blow to Ukraine, and he can't deliver a blow against Islamic State without actually having to admit that Islamic State was responsible. So he's left in a situation that, much like King Lear, he's threatening the terrors of the world. What they are, he knows not, but they will be.
To bring it back finally to Islamic State, then, the perpetrators of this appalling attack on the Crocus Concert Hall last Friday, is there any strategic sense from their point of view to attacking a target like that in Moscow? And the reason for asking that question is to wonder whether they might be considering doing something similar again.
Look, I'm sure they are considering any kind of attack that is available to them. The fact of the matter is Islamic State has a regular tally of attempts to commit terrorist attacks within Russia. More often than not, these are forestalled by the security forces. Indeed, earlier this month, there was a planned armed attack on a synagogue in Kaluga region, which the Federal Security Service swept down upon. I think really, from their point of view, any attacks on the Russian state and the Russian people are worthwhile in their own right for two reasons. One is just generally an ideology of struggle, which is a polite way of saying liking killing people. But the other one is actually, and I think this is one of the reasons why Putin is so unwilling to blame Islamic State, is they are hoping to push the Kremlin into the kind of heavy-handed crackdown on the millions of Central Asians and Muslims who live within Russia, which would be the perfect recruiting sergeant. And already, I think we're beginning to see some kind of a nationalist backlash against Central Asians, who are absolutely essential at the moment to the Russian economy, which is in, after all, a labor crisis at the moment. So in some ways, it's opportunistic. It's whenever they actually have the chance to strike, and they're hoping that one day, one of these strikes will make Putin or his successor go all out in terms of, you know, fighting back against Islamic State, and in the process persecute millions of Muslims, pushing a certain number of them into supporting jihadism.
Mark Galeotti, thank you. That was the Russia expert and author of Putin's Wars, Mark Galeotti. You're listening to The Foreign Desk. This is The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller. A startling subplot of Islamic State's attack on Moscow on March 22nd was that in the weeks beforehand, the United States warned privately and publicly that something of the sort was likely, specifically mentioning that concerts were a likely target for a planned attack by extremists. Well, joining me now from Arlington, Virginia, is General David Petraeus, former director of the Central Intelligence Agency. General Petraeus is also the author, along with Andrew Roberts, of Conflict, the Evolution of Warfare, from 1945 to Ukraine. General, I want to go back, first of all, to this warning that the US shared with Russia on March the 7th, in fact announced publicly on March the 7th. Is it possible to explain the means by which the United States might have acquired an inkling of an attack in Russia, apparently carried out by Tajik nationals associated with a group based in Afghanistan?
It's possible, but I'm not going to give any kind of specifics, which would be speculation in any event. The bottom line is that the intelligence community has a variety of sources and methods. Presumably, they have been tracking activities of the Islamic State Khorasan group, which is the element, sort of a wing of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria that we helped the Iraqi security forces and Syrian democratic forces defeat when they had a caliphate, the first ever Islamist extremist caliphate in northern Iraq and northeastern Syria. And of course, the reason our forces are still in Iraq is to support the Iraqis and the Syrian Democratic Forces as they keep an eye and pressure on the Islamic State, because we've learned the hard way that if you take your eye off them, if you take pressure off them, they can reconstitute, as was the case with the Islamic State when we departed Iraq with our final combat forces in late 2011.
What kind of conversations would go on, though, within an intelligence agency about whether to make that information public and how much of it to make public?
Well, the duty to warn policy was adopted not quite a decade ago, and it basically holds that when you have threat indications, intelligence on the potential for a terrorist activity or any other kind of significant threat like that, the general information should be shared with counterparts in a foreign country where it apparently is being planned and may be conducted, whether or not that country is friend or foe or adversary. And that was the case here. Reportedly, the intelligence community shared this with counterparts in Moscow either once or twice. Obviously, the FSB, in this case, the Internal Security Service of Russia, was not able to prevent this one, although they did actually detain in two other cases in recent weeks elements that they have said were also from the Islamic State Khorasan group.
What did you make of President Vladimir Putin's response to that warning, both before the attack and after it? Because before the attack, he suggested that almost as if this was some sort of American psyops stunt to sow fear and disunity in Russia, whereas afterwards, of course, he has attempted to deflect blame in the direction of Ukraine.
Well, what I made of it was nonsense that he dismissed the reports of a potential threat in a way that was clearly foolish and made him look quite foolish afterward. And then the attempt to blame the Ukrainians is just ludicrous, especially because Turkey has reported that these individuals transited their soil en route to Russia. So again, typical of the Kremlin, frankly, typical of Putin, as you said, to sow disinformation, to try to put the blame on others always, never accepting any blame himself or for his particular elements.
In general, though, is there still an amount of cooperation between intelligence services, even of countries which are not, by and large, very friendly with each other, if they think there is a perhaps a common threat that they're dealing with, going back to the duty to warn concept you were mentioning?
Well, there are always relationships. Again, people do talk to each other, counterparts talk to each other and so forth, even in difficult situations like the one in Russia. There's a long history of that. Heck, we were negotiating with the Soviet Union when we were in the height of the Cold War, or the depths of the Cold War, however you want to phrase it. So that always goes on. And again, with the concept, the policy of duty to warn, that in a sense formalizes the requirement to share such information. But there's lots of conversations back and forth. Those take place. And indeed, you know, our current director of the CIA has been to Russia, has sought to maintain communications. Churchill had it right, I think, when he said jaw-jaw is better than war-war. Not that this is preventing war-war, but again, having open lines of communication is quite important. And in fact, we saw how important it is when you don't have it, when the Chinese spy balloon floated over the United States and the Pentagon picked up the hotline and nobody in Beijing answered.
And just finally on this, is there a wider warning perhaps here that other countries besides Russia should infer from that attack in Moscow that Islamic State really is not done as a threat far beyond the country from which it operates?
Sure. No, look, we've seen this particular element of the Islamic State carry out two horrific attacks in Iran over the course of the last year or so. It's carried out an attack almost every week or so inside Afghanistan itself. It's probably carried out attacks in Pakistan on a reasonably regular basis. But what this demonstrates is the reach. Again, this is starting to get quite significant. Remember that during the days of the first ever Islamist extremist caliphate, the one established by ISIS in northern Iraq and northeastern Syria, at their height, they were inspiring others, directing others, sharing information with others for attacks in places like Paris and Brussels. So this is a warning, and clearly there's going to have to be greater attention given to the Islamic State Khorasan group and its various activities in Afghanistan in particular, but also really in the neighbors of Afghanistan, because the Khorasan region actually is more than just Afghanistan. It's the countries around it as well.
General Petraeus, thank you. That was General David Petraeus, former director of the CIA. His book, Conflict, The Evolution of Warfare from 1945 to Ukraine, is out now. You're listening to The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller. For a look at Islamic State's current activities in the Middle East and Central Asia, I'm joined now by Dr. Sanam Vakil, Director of the Middle East and North Africa Program at Chatham House. Well, let's start very broadly with Islamic State in the Middle East. Whereabouts is it still actually active?
Well, the Islamic State has been dislodged from the caliphate that they announced and established between Iraq and Syria. So most of the entities have gone underground, but they have reemerged with offshoots in and around Afghanistan and in Syria as well, but they're just not as active.
When people think of Islamic State now, I think the recollection is still tied to that period during which it was quite a substantial geographical entity in the Middle East, controlling huge swaths of Syria and Iraq. Does any of that Islamic State still exist, not in terms of its territory, but in terms of its personnel?
Some of the fighters from that period do very much exist. There are two camps in Syria under U.S. control that are detaining a lot of ISIS fighters from that period of time as well. But of course, a lot of the senior leadership have been killed and eliminated.
Do they still have, as far as it is possible to tell, any kind of constituency among the Middle East people or the wider region? Is there any genuine sympathy for them?
Well, it's very hard to say, really, because they espouse such a radical interpretation of Islam and governance. And there wasn't a groundswell of support in the Middle East at the time. I would say that they do and they can still attract support from more radicalized parts of the population, but by no means would I say that they're overwhelming.
Before the attack on Moscow last week, probably the last major terrorist attack that they had been associated with was the bombing of Qasem Soleimani's burial site in Iran in January. Do we understand which version of Islamic State that was? Was it any kind of descendant of the Islamic State Caliphate?
Yes, the assumption is that both attacks actually have been sponsored by the Islamic State of Khorasan, which is a group that emerged in 2015. If you can imagine being more radical, they're quite radical anti-Shia and looking to resurrect a caliphate in the geographical and historical location of Khorasan, which is Central Asia, Iran, and the Caucasus.
So they do still have, despite the defeat and dismantling of their previous caliphate, some ambition of controlling territory again?
Absolutely, yes. They are looking to push back against corrupt and un-Islamic governments and even non-state actors throughout the region. ISIS Khorasan is even more radical ideologically than ISIS or Al-Qaeda, and they have anti-Iranian orientation. They've even butted heads with the Taliban, if you can imagine. So their agenda is to resurrect a really strict, dogmatic caliphate in that territory.
Is it clear at this point, absent controlling substantial amounts of territory, what they're doing for money, how the movement is funded?
It isn't clear precisely, certainly in the open source material, but I'm sure governments and intelligence officers are keeping track. From what we do understand is without the geography, it's harder to raise funds through taxes. Certainly there are independent donations that are a source of income, but there is, of course, the sort of criminality behind these groups whether it's human trafficking, drug smuggling, these illicit activities also serve as income streams.
Do we know where things like individual donations would be coming from? Is this any kind of state sponsorship, even at one remove, or are there, and it's hard to imagine what interest wealthy individuals could have in propping up Islamic State, but are there wealthy individuals who do somehow perceive an interest in doing that?
Well, I think it is about your ideological or religious orientation. If you are a wealthy individual, or even you're contributing zakat, you're tithing as a Muslim, you could see perhaps that this group is a beneficiary, because particularly in the context of wars and the war in Gaza, for example, they're trying to exploit this crisis to show lack of accountability, poor governance for their own political purposes.
It's always kind of an open question, I think, at least, where theocratically motivated militia groups are concerned. But is it your view that when they talk about their particular Islamist ideology and the kind of society they would like to create and their reasons for wanting to create it, do you think they're actually entirely sincere, that this is genuinely what they believe, or do they perceive the religious aspect of this as a means to a political end?
I think that they're certainly an important component of diehards within this group. You cannot just rely on the political motivations or the power motivations on its own. I think that there are real believers that sincerely see living in a more ideological and pure, by the way they see it, version of Islam as practiced during the time of the Prophet Muhammad as being important for their, you know, religious practice. But then, of course, as Muslims, they also see it as important to spread that view and that way of life.
Given the implicit unwillingness to compromise involved there, and as you've said, we are talking about people who believe that the Taliban and the Islamic Republic of Iran are kind of part-timers and lightweights on the whole Islam front. Is there any imaginable means of combating Islamic State, even as it now is, other than military?
Well, I think that the go-to by Western states and policymakers, as well as Middle Eastern states, is always the military solution. But I think that that on its own isn't effective. You have to consider why people are mobilized with this radical thinking, why they see violence as an important means to securing power. And I think much of that has to be addressed through long-term strategic engagement, empowerment of local communities, investment in the structural inequities and balances that exist in many parts of the world where there are no jobs, no ability for growth, advancement, and basics effectively. So it is a very different approach than solely focusing on the military.
And just finally, their attack on that theater in Moscow last week has clearly come as something of a jolt to wider Europe, which I think kind of like the idea that Islamic State as a motivator of terrorism had sort of peaked. Do we have to resign ourselves to the prospect that Moscow may not be the limit of their ambitions, that even this Central Asia-focused ISIS-K might, for whatever reason, want to strike further west?
Certainly. A group like ISIS-K, ISIS and even Al-Qaeda has not been eradicated. They're dormant. They're recapitalizing and waiting to seize on opportunities to advance their own political and ideological interests. And vacuums of power, the war in Gaza is certainly going to radicalize large portion of sort of disenfranchised communities across the Middle East and Central Asia. We're already seeing it through propaganda, through posts and videos on social media. And I think that it's not a question of if, it's a question of when we're going to see their resurgence. And I think Middle Eastern states are acutely aware of these threats. And that's been part of their deep concern about the prolongation of the war as well.
Sanam, thank you. That was Sanam Vakil, Director of the Middle East and North Africa Program at Chatham House. This is the Foreign Desk on Monocle Radio. And finally, on today's show, I'm joined by Dr. Stig Jarl Hansen, Senior Associate Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute and an expert on Islamism in the Horn of Africa. Dr. Hansen is the author of several books, including Horn, Sahel and Rift, Fault Lines of the African Jihad. He joins me now from just near Oslo. First of all, give us, if you would, some idea of Islamic State's reach in Africa now. Where are they operating and how big a deal are they?
You have one outfit of the Islamic State in the Greater Sahara operating between Niger and Mali, and it's doing quite well, actually. And then you have another outfit of the Islamic State, which is basically Islamic State's western province, and that's also doing relatively well. You have the province in Mozambique, which is kind of rebounding after the Erwandan intervention in Mozambique. And you have the Central African province of the Islamic State in the Congo, in the border areas between Congo, Uganda, and a little bit Rwanda. And then you have the weakest outfit of the sub-Saharan outfits, which is the Islamic State in Somalia.
How much, I guess, cooperation, communication is there between these Islamic States? Is it really helpful to think of them as a single organization, or are they entirely separate, discrete things which just happen to have similar branding?
I think it's a little bit of both, actually. All of these outfits feeds on local grievances and have to adopt to local politics. For example, the Islamic State in Sahara is feeding into internal cleavages and local conflicts, basically, and also conflicts between Fulani and neighbors. And it's very often the case the Islamic State in Somalia will feed into the grievances of the Ali Suleiman clan. So you feed into local animosities. But on the funding side, it seems to have been some kind of link. So it seems that in West Africa, there has been money traveling back and forth. It seems like the Central African province have been funded from Nairobi by links that it shares with other organizations in Africa. So there is some kind of finance links. When that is said, I have to underline that the most common form of financing for most of these outfits is really local taxation. So they tax the local population and pressure them to pay money.
Taxation of that sort is obviously hugely enabled by the actual possession of territory. And there are reports that Islamic State do hold an amount of territory, for example, in the Gao region of Mali. But going back to what you were saying earlier about how some of these branches were doing quite well, at least by their own merits, are they actually potentially a threat to the integrity of any established African states? Could we see an actual takeover of large regions like we did 10 years ago in Iraq and Syria?
I think the country to watch now is Mali, because the Malian state is definitively on the defensive, even though it has help from the Russians these days. You can see that there's new attacks around Bamako, not in Bamako, but also the Islamic State here will face some difficulties. It has to operate parallel with other outfits like Al-Qaeda's local affiliate, JNIM. So even in Mali, it's going to be hard for them, but maybe not so much because of the Malian government forces, but because of some of the Tuareg militias and also Al-Qaeda's local outfits.
Mali, like Burkina Faso in Niger, has recently been overtaken by its own military, and that military has ejected other Western forces that were peacekeeping to one extent or another on their territory. So we've seen the French sent packing, we've seen the United States sort of sent packing by Niger more recently. If those Western troops all go and security is trusted to the Wagner Group, for example, or some other Russian proxy, does that present Islamic State with an opportunity?
I think we have to keep in mind that although France saved Bamako from the attacks in 2012 and 2013, it managed to stay there for over a decade without achieving anything. And that's part of the problems with France, that it actually didn't establish itself properly on the ground to protect the local population. And you said previously that you need to have territorial control in order to tax. But the fact is, if you don't protect the local population in the area that you supposedly control, as France did, then basically the jihadist outfits can tax anyway. So they don't need to control things in the open. That's what I call semi-territoriality in my book, and it's very common. The thing is, that's the mistake France did, but it seems like it's going to be the mistakes that the Russians are going to do as well. So the Russians haven't learned anything from basically the failure of France to solve this problem. I also think that some leaders in the West, military leaders, have thought about the interventions in Africa as a kind of management. The main priority is to stop attacks from these outfits to take place in Europe. And that, I think, is kind of the same thing that Russia is thinking. A little bit about minerals, a little bit about business interests. The problem with that is that you don't have a long-term strategy and you will encounter large-scale problems when you continue. So I don't think the Russians would do any better than France in the long term.
Given all that, is it therefore actually not impossible that the situation may degenerate to the point at which Western intervention of some sort does become, well, not just necessary, but unavoidable, whether the local governments like it or not?
We will see. Western interventions in the past have been good to keep status quo. They've been unsuccessful in winning the war, and I don't think that's sustainable solutions either. But Mali will have some issues, that's for sure. You can see not first and foremost the Islamic State, but JNIM crawling southwards and staging attacks around the capital. And you can see some issues in Nigeria also. What's interesting with Nigeria is it's not necessarily the jihadists, it's not necessarily Islamic State's Western African province. But what you can see is actually a lot of banditry increasing in the north, especially in the northwest. So the question is if the Nigerian state can handle it. And the problem with the West now is that we tried to fight all of these wars, we didn't win any of them, really. That kind of draws down basically the will to intervene. So several Western nations is probably looking for African nations that can intervene, but there's problems with that as well, because the countries that looked like they were African great powers, like Nigeria, like South Africa, like Ethiopia, are not really great powers at all. You know, Nigeria have large issues inside Nigeria that they couldn't solve properly and at times needed help from Chad to solve. And South Africa is becoming more and more isolationist. So the question is which countries are left? And some would point to Rwanda. They successfully intervened in Mozambique against the Islamic State forces there. Some would point to Ghana, experienced country in intervening around the world. Some would point to Algeria, but Algeria have a very miserable human rights record. So that's the drawback. And some would point to Chad that has been quite active, but the relationship between the government and the opposition is quite vulnerable. And the opposition is kind of pro-Russian, which can lead to some issues in the longer run.
Dr. Stig Jarl Hansen, thank you very much for joining us. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Emma Searle and Christy O'Grady. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. To contact The Foreign Desk team, you can email Emma at es@monocle.com. And don't forget to subscribe to Monocle magazine and to our free daily email bulletins by heading to our website at monocle.com. From me, Andrew Muller, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.